The issues that matter most, right here. The Drew Mariani Show
on Relevant Radio.
Senators have voted to temporarily extend the U.S. debt ceiling. The agreement reached between Democrats and Republicans raises the country's debt limit by $480 billion, which the Treasury Department says will cover the country's debt obligations until December 3rd. That's the same day that the short-term government funding bill will also expire.
It's definitely not the end of the road. The House now would need to pass this bill, and we saw earlier today, Speaker Pelosi, in a letter to her Democratic colleagues, indicating that she would be willing potentially to bring them back into session to do that. Once that happens, then the bill goes to the White House.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Well, good afternoon and welcome. Great to be back here with you today. A lot happening there on Capitol Hill. That was news from CBS earlier this morning, reporting that the Senate, of course, approved that short-term extension of the debt ceiling within a 50-48 vote. And the measure now goes to the House, which would get a vote next week. And the bill, this is all we've been talking about, right? It's going to raise the debt limit. We're going to continue to spend. It's going to raise the debt limit by $480 billion. And that just gets us to December, right? Early December. But here's the thing. It avoids a default, and it will end what has been a weeks-long standoff between Democrats and Republicans. This is an interesting story in this respect. Yesterday the Senate voted to temporarily lift, and again, temporarily lift the ceiling, so we can pay our bills until December. The Democrats had originally tried to lift the ceiling to their $3.5 trillion social spending bill. But the Republicans, they weren't going along with it. They're saying, hey, no, you don't want to consult us with anything. You want to raise the debt. You want to allow us to, the debt ceiling, you want to allow us to give you unbridled rein to spend money. You can put your own fingerprints on that. So with the looming deadline of October 18th, which was the date the Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen said that the U.S. would officially default if the debt wasn't being, if it wasn't lifted, the Republicans made an offer. They extended a hand, an olive branch, to lift the ceiling just for a specific amount of money and time. Of course, the Democrats agreed to that, and for now at least, the U.S. is going to be able to meet its financial obligations. But there's such ugliness and such vitriol, there on Capitol Hill, and it's tragic. I saw right after this went down, right after this happened, Chuck Schumer, he's the Senate Majority Leader there. He's the Democrat from New York. He actually blasted the Republican Party. He says, what they were doing is both dangerous and it's a risky partisan game. And he says that Republicans tried to push us off a cliff. And he made those comments right after, GOP leaders worked for hours to secure just enough votes to end this debate and allow the Democrats to pass that short-term debt ceiling increase. And Republicans afterwards were upset. I mean, they angrily confronted Schumer after his speech. Well, again, why would you do that? I mean, why can't we have any civility? You have your way. We got some extension going on here. Why do you have to throw those types of barbs? So, Joe Manchin, whose state is relatively red, he's out of West Virginia. He's a Democrat, and he and Sinema out of Arizona. Those two have really been, key players in all that's unfolding with this $3.5 trillion bill and so much more. You could see Joe Manchin, as Schumer is, calling Republicans out, he just had his head down. He had his hands over his face as Schumer was saying this type of stuff. So it doesn't go well. Look, midterm elections are coming up soon, and there's going to be a lot that's going to be playing out in the not too distant future. So we'll see. We'll see what happens. We'll see how government changes. But this is my caution to you. Know who you are voting for. It's not just the guy at the top of the list. It's not just the president when you go in. And make sure you vote in your midterms. Make sure you vote for moral people. Make sure you know the policies and the platforms on which they stand. It doesn't take a whole lot of work. You can do a little bit of research. You can make a couple phone calls even if you want to. There's a lot of information out there. But you and we have profound ability to change the country. And we think, oh, I'm just one vote. Yeah, if everybody did their part, believe me, we could get things right. Right now, I think there's just unbridled spending and just a ton of confusion in the country right now. And you see what we're doing with life and all these other policies that are coming down, the Equality Act and all these things I've talked about for months that are just not good for the country. They're not good for our children. They're not good for you and for me. They're not good because they go against God's natural law, you know, and it's many of them are just wrong. You and I have to do our part, make our sacrifices. Yeah, we have to pray, but we also have to be politically active and do our part when it comes to what's happening. Call your representative and make sure when you have the opportunity to let your voice be heard in a vote, you do it. You know, there's not much in the media about this right now. And it's something that really has grown kind of quiet. I thought we could just touch on this just briefly. There are still Americans stuck in Afghanistan. I was reading about this the other day. You know, Los Angeles Times was reporting that there are about 38 students and parents from Sacramento and San Diego school districts that have not been able to get back home. I mean, that's unbelievable. Now, I'd be concerned if that was my wife, my children. There are students stranded there in Afghanistan. Here, I'll give you a quick overview, and then we can talk a little bit about it. This comes from NBC Sacramento. They said number of students still stuck in a Taliban-ruled country. Listen.
Other news, including learning more about the people who were stuck in Afghanistan following the last flight of the United States taking off out of Afghanistan. Let's get to our right now. They pulled the last military member out of Afghanistan. They've deemed it over, but there are still U.S. citizens stuck in that country.
Yeah, specifically some students right now stuck from California. This information is just coming into the newsroom. We know 29 students from the Sacramento area are still in Afghanistan. The San Juan Unified School District confirms 29 students from 19 families are still in Afghanistan. The school district offering support up to the families right now, but the students from the group, a couple of them were evacuated earlier last week. It was a larger group. It's now a smaller number, but they were there for multiple reasons. The Sacramento area actually hosts one of the largest populations of Afghani immigrants in the United States. At this moment, it's not clear if these students from Sacramento are U.S. citizens, but right now we're working to get more information.
All right, so keep them in your prayers. That's a terrifying thought for anyone who's got loved ones over there. They're Americans. You know, and they're stuck there in that country. Most were, you know, Afghan immigrants who had gone back to visit family during the summer and got caught behind the lines, weren't able to make it out during the pandemonium that unfolded, you know, ensued when President Biden ordered the withdrawal of U.S. troops and then ordered civilians out of there. So, boy, I just wish we did those things differently. But my heart goes out to them. We'll remember them during our chaplet today, which comes up in about 45, 50 minutes, so you can always pray with me a little bit later. There's a lot going on we should pray for, too, on the life stage. Let me bring you up to speed on this. I know this can be a big disconnect for a lot of people, and you don't get this reporting at all from your mainstream outlets, and that's why I think it's important at least to put this before you so you know what's going on and you can do your part to pray and take action against this. On the life stage, the highest court in the United Kingdom turn its back on people with Down syndrome. And this is something that's very troubling. There was a woman named Heidi Crowther. She's 26 years old. She's had Down syndrome. Two others sued the Department of Health and Social, the Health and Social Department there to be part of what they call the Abortion Act, which allows abortion up till birth if the child has Down syndrome. So if you have a child in your womb that has Down syndrome, you can terminate it right up to birth. It's discriminatory. Of course, it violates the European Convention on Human Rights. But, you know, many within the Scottish Down syndrome community have voiced their disappointment at the decision. And they say, hey, life, these laws just don't respect life. And STV News in UK did a recent report on this. Let me just share a little bit of this with you as well.
Heidi Crowther, a 26-year-old woman living with Down syndrome, in a legal battle with the UK government arguing her country's abortion stance discriminates against her. But after years of campaigning, Heidi's case was dismissed last Thursday. It wasn't the news she hoped for, but vowed to keep fighting.
We face discrimination every day in schools, in the workplace, and in the society. Thanks to the verdict, the judges have upheld discrimination in the womb too.
And so it was, thanks Maggie. Maggie and I were just talking about the the audio there. Sometimes those accents are a little bit hard to understand. What the High Court is saying, and I'll just wrap it up on this point, they say, quote, the fundamental difficulty is that the European Court has never decided that a fetus, even one post-viability, is the bearer of convention rights. This is the problem with Roe v. Wade, too, right? I mean, back in 73, they didn't know when life began. I think science is really the answer to this whole issue. When does life begin? And as soon as that begins, I would argue at the moment of conception, then that human being has rights, right? Has rights. It's a serious issue for us in the States. It's a serious issue for Europe. You talk about the darkness. This is what happens when sin enters into our life, right? Both on a personal level, but also what happens more on a national level as well. What was once wrong no longer seems wrong, and what was unimaginable suddenly becomes imaginable, right? Belgium, for example, and this is bizarre, they're now euthanizing kids. Yeah, you heard me right. According to a recent report, 10% of the children who died in infancy last year, they were euthanized. Here in the U.S., a 51-year-old mother who had ALS, former colleague John Harper, had sent this over to me. He sent me a story earlier today saying, in our own country, a woman battling Lou Gehrig's disease, right, that's ALS, says she wants to die by euthanasia this coming Sunday night. So we're going to pray for her during the chapel. I'm going to pray that she has a conversion, that she can understand that life is worth living. Her name is Martha Sepulveda, I think, and she said, the report I read, she just can't bear the thought of the suffering that she's, you know, that this disease is going to bring about. You know, it's a debilitating disease. It's a tough way to die. Anyone who has Lou Gehrig's disease or somebody who has a loved one, you know what it's like. So she says, I'm going to be put to death. So I would ask you to pray for her. Put her on your prayer list today, and just we'll pray that God in his mercy will keep her from doing that. You know, it's sad. One other story here too, that is something I've been tracking. And again, I don't know how much coverage you're going to hear about this, but I've often said, you know, life was the big issue. We saw the bad fruit of that decision on so many different levels, right? We saw the bad fruit of the contraceptive pill. It goes back that far, really. And even no fault of force, but look at abortion. From abortion, now we have Roe v. Wade. And when the Obergefell decision went down, I said, look, you're going to see other things. It's not just about two people wanting to be married and having these civil unions and to be having them recognized. It's much more than that. You're going to see the bad fruit of it. You're going to see polyamory. You're going to see polygamy. You're going to see man-boy love. You're going to see all this bizarre stuff, which you right now say, oh, no way, that'll never happen. We'll never accept that, right? But that's what happens. And I said, you know, in the crosshairs of your future and mine is our religious freedom, our religious liberty. And I'm beginning to see little stories that are coming across the radar here that say, you know what? You're right. You're beginning to see it. It's an inch here, an inch there. Before you know it, you're a foot further away from where you were. There's a township in Michigan. They're facing a religious freedom lawsuit because guess what? It won't allow a hospital group to build a prayer center dedicated to Padre Pio. So the Diocese of Lansing, they have 40 acres of land, right? It's a rural area. They donated it to a group called Catholic Healthcare International. And the land was donated for a specific purpose, just to erect a chapel for adoration, all right? So here's this Catholic group. We want to build a Catholic chapel on this land donated by the Diocese of Lansing. So the people in the township of Genoa, they heard rumors that this was going to bring all kinds of traffic, you know, and none of it, of course, was true. And the township officials decided not to issue permits that they needed to build this chapel. So the Catholic Healthcare International Group, they filed a lawsuit against the township alleging, look, our First Amendment freedom of religion is being violated. You're violating our First Amendment rights. We're going to dive into this. I'll spend more time on this on Monday. I'll unpack it for you. I think it's an important story to look at. But you know what? This is what's happening. You know, now you can't build a Catholic church. What's next? You can't build an adoration chapel? On some other fronts here, there's a new doctor of the church coming. I just saw a story today that Pope Francis announced at a recent meeting with Eastern Orthodox prelates. He's going to name St. Irenaeus of Lyon is a doctor of the church. He's going to name him the Doctor of Unity. Now, doctors of the church, there's not many of them, right? You might know some of the big guns like Thomas Aquinas or St. Augustine. There are currently only 35 doctors of the church who are recognized for their learning, for their teaching, for their revelation, if you will. They're unlocking the secrets, if you will, of our faith and helping us to more deeply learn and love our faith, to understand it. And Irenaeus lived at the very end of the second century, and he heard the preachings of St. Polycarp, and he actually became the bishop of present-day Lyon in France, and he has a very famous work that he wrote against the heresies, and he refuted the teaching of Gnosticism at the time, but he's going to be elevated. This is great. Another doctor of the church. There's a petition underway right now to have St. Faustina declared a doctor of the church, and I really hope that one day we see that happen as well. So with that diary of St. Faustina, the revelations about the mercy of God, I have no doubt. And again, you know what I love about this? Third grade education. You don't need postdoctoral degrees, right? You don't. You just, to be a doctor of the church, the Holy Spirit does all the work, all the teaching. Hey, Patrick Nowakowski is going to be stopping by. Today's the anniversary of a great, great event. And I don't know where you were, if even people know what happened on this day. And I'll give you a little bit of trivia or a little bit of history when I came back. Today's the anniversary, believe it or not, of the entrustment of the third millennium by John Paul II to Our Lady. Big, big day in the church, that's for sure. Also, we'll be talking a little bit about the great Peshtigo fire. A lot took place in our own country here on this day. So I'll get you plugged into that and a whole lot more when I return.
Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio Studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forester.
Chicago in 1871 was ripe for a huge fire. The city was built primarily out of wood. Wooden houses and buildings were built very close together. Wooden sidewalks were elevated over muddy streets, and a dozen wooden bridges spanned the Chicago River. The spring and summer of that year brought little rain, creating unusually dry conditions that made all of this wood dry. To make matters worse, on the evening of October 8th, a violent wind began to blow from the southwest, which would eventually help spread the fire that started in the western part of the city, and drive it straight into the heart of the city. The fire burned for 2 days before it finally began to rain, but not before the city was in ruins. Nearly 300 people lost their lives, and more than 90,000 were left without shelter, food, water, or anything besides what they were wearing. The fire destroyed 18,000 buildings in just over 3 miles of the cityscape. By the way, the fire did indeed begin modestly in the cowshed behind the O'Leary's property, but likely by one of their tenants who discarded a lit cigarette during a family celebration of the recent arrival of a relative from Ireland.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
There you have it. We'll talk about the great Peshtigo fire coming up. You know, we all talk about the Chicago fire, of course, and what happened on this day back in 1871. And I love what Father said, supposedly started by Mrs. O'Leary's cow tipping over a kerosene lamp, but that's bad journalism. And the journalists actually fessed up and confessed what happened. But on that same day, there was another fire, even more severe. And I'll share what happened because I saw the hand of God in that fire. We clearly know that that fire was prophesied. And we also know that a miracle took place that safeguarded those who turned to God with trust and prayed. If you're not familiar with it, you'll love the story. I'll get you plugged into it in a second. But first, let me share with you today. I reflect back on my own life, and I say to God, man, thank you for being so good to me. I look at the places I've been and the people I've met, the saints that I have encountered in my own life, you know, and I was very fortunate to be present at the beatification of St. Faustina and the canonization of other saints. And on October 8th in the year 2000, I, by God's providence, happened to be in Rome, and I was present for a very historic event. the day that John Paul entrusted the world and the third millennium to Our Lady. That was so significant. The graces that flowed from that event over this new millennium, I think, are still yet to be seen. The ceremony was the culmination of the Jubilee of Bishops. There were 1,500 bishops and 80 cardinals from all over the world. They concelebrated Mass with the Pope. And at the end of the Mass, Holy Father knelt before a statue of Our Lady, and he brought her from her shrine at Fatima for this occasion. And he read an act of entrustment for the third millennium. And in this beautiful delivery, he noted that devotion to Our Lady and to those who, you know, those whose care Jesus entrusted us, even as he died, is more than ever necessary in the world. You know, our Lord on the cross turned to us and he gave us his mother. She became our spiritual mother at that moment. And he said humanity is at a crossroads. This future saint, you know, in the year 2000, said humanity is at the crossroads. This act of entrustment, just for some historical perspective, it follows the 1984 consecration of Russia. A lot of people say, oh, Russia was never officially consecrated. Yeah, this is kind of a 1-2 punch, in my opinion. You know, 84, John Paul did consecrate the world to the Immaculate Heart, and Sister Lucio dos Santos said that the words of the act, you know, were accepted by heaven. They weren't exactly as Our Lady had requested, but they were. And, you know, John Paul said, look, the world faces challenges which lie hidden in the future. And as you know, he had a special devotion to Our Lady. He lost his mother very young. And many close to him believe that John Paul II actually had visions of the Mother of God himself. You know, he credits Our Lady in particular for his narrow escape from death by the assassination on that night, that fateful day in 1981 when, you know, the Turkish assassin fired on him and put a bullet in him. And the bullet was taken from his body, and ultimately he put it in the crown of Our Lady of Fatima. He said one hand pulled the trigger, the other, it guided the bullet. It guided the bullet. And let me just share this, and I want to get Patrick on, and he'll give us some perspective on this. I want to share just a couple sentences from what he said on that day. You know, he did this beautiful act of entrustment for all of humanity to the Mother of God. And if you're not in a relation with the Blessed Mother, I want to encourage you to do that. She will speed you into the arms of her Son. You know, he entrusted the world on the dawn of the third millennium. And he says, today we entrust to you the future that awaits us. And we ask you to be with us on our way. We are the men and women of an extraordinary time, exhilarating yet full of contradictions. Humanity now has instruments of unprecedented power. We can turn this world into a garden, or we can reduce it to a pile of rubble. We've devised the astounding capacity to intervene in the very wellspring of life. Man can cause this power for good within the bounds of moral law, or he can succumb to the short-sightedness of pride of a science that accepts no limits and tramples on the respect due every human being. Today, as never before in the past, humanity stands at a crossroad. And once again, O most holy Virgin, salvation lies fully and uniquely in Jesus, your Son. And then he entrusted all of humanity to her. You know, beginning with the weak, he entrusted the babies yet unborn, those living in poverty, those suffering, the young, the unemployed, you know, those suffering from disease. He entrusted troubled families. He went through this beautiful litany of entrustment and put the world in the Immaculate Heart of Our Lady. I'm joined this afternoon by somebody who knows the life and the teachings of John Paul II intimately. He's the author of a book called 100 Ways, John Paul II Changed the World. You can find out more by going to novamedia.us. It's great to have back Patrick Nowakowski. Patrick, good afternoon. Thanks for your patience.
Drew, always good to be with you.
Yeah, it's great to have you here. 21 years ago today, John Paul the Great prayed and entrusted the entire world to the millennium. Fill us in. Bring me back in time. What motivated this? Have we seen the fruits of it? It seems like the world's still a very troubled place, but give me some historical perspective, if you could.
Well, you know, this is actually seen as the zenith point, the high point of the Jubilee year. We all seen the pictures of the Holy Father pushing open the Holy Door to begin the Holy Year, the Great Jubilee in late 1999. And he was very weak, very frail. Still, you know, 5 years before he actually died, he still had a lot of life in him. But he really, and this actually take a step back, that, you know, there are writings and rumors that when he met Padre Pio as a young bishop, yeah, during the Second Vatican Council, that Padre Pio said that you will be the Pope. And, you know, but it was also, take you back to his mentor, Bishop Cardinal Wyszynski, who said that if you are elected Pope, you will lead the church into the third millennium. So I think, you know, part of John Paul's whole mentality, I guess you could say, as Pope was, okay, we have to have a plan between his election in 1978 and the year 2000 of where the church needs to be. A lot of that was unpacking the Second Vatican Council, because that was one of the things that God entrusted him with. He was a very young bishop, one of the youngest bishops at the start of the council. Also, as you very well mentioned, divine mercy. God placed him in Poland during the time of Faustina and gave him the role of bishop, cardinal and bishop of Krakow to, if you will, to start her canonization process and to validate her diary and prepare the world for the second coming of Jesus Christ. So there's a lot that God gave to him, and a big part of this is the Great Jubilee, which was his grand vision for how the church should operate moving into the third millennium. And as you said, and you're so blessed to be there, I wish I would have been able to be there as well. This, I think most people miss this, because it was the largest gathering of bishops since the Second Vatican Council. They're in Rome for the Jubilee gathering of bishops. And here, one of the first things he did was he gave a charge to the bishops to really fulfill their role. He says that the bishops are called to defend and promote the doctrinal unity of their faith. And that was part of his consecration, is to give that charge to his brother bishops. So there's a lot here to unpack on this historic day.
Yeah, I just love what John Paul was able to do. He knew the times in which we lived. He knew how special they were. A lot of people questioned his consecration, his fulfillment of the Fatima promise on that March 25th, 1984. Day in which he entrusted the entire world. He didn't mention Russia specifically by name. And then you fast forward to the year 2000, this millennia, he canonizes Saint Faustina. She becomes the first saint of the new millennium. And on October 8th, he goes ahead and he entrusts the entire world to Our Lady. What was playing out here? Was this an underlining of what he did back in 84? I mean, what is it about entrustment and consecration and these particular figures, both the you know, to Our Lady and to Saint Faustina, that he thought were so critical for these times?
You know, actually, in my preparation for this segment, I was thinking the same thing. What's the difference between entrustment and consecration? Is it the same thing, just different nuance? But going back to the question about whether this fulfills the prophecy at Fatima, the charge to consecrate Russia, I go with Sister Lucia. I mean, she was there. She talked to Our Lady. She got the message. If she says it's legitimate, then, you know, you pretty much have to take her at her word, right? So I think his consecration in 1984 was fine. And I think, but more importantly, I think John Paul saw this as it's the beginning of the third millennium of Christianity. And we need to do this right. And this is, you know, I think he spent decades thinking about this, praying about this, begging our Lord to inspire him on how to carry out this program, as they kind of say in Europe, this plan of how to bring the church into the third millennium. And the capstone, consecrating the world and the third millennium to the Blessed Mother. No, and not only did he bring that statue from Fatima, but it that was the statue that had the bullet they pulled out of him welded into the crown. So he was intimately connected with Our Lady throughout his life, but even more so with Fatima, given that the assassination attempt was on the Feast of Our Lady of Fatima, and that bullet he placed in the crown, and it was there in Rome. He didn't go back to Fatima. I think late 90s or something was the last time that he went to Fatima, but the statue came to him in Rome for this amazing consecration.
Yeah, he was so devoted to Our Blessed Mother. And I think in large part, you know, we know he lost his mother very young and had his father. But I think Our Lady had a special relation with him. Some speculate that he actually had special communion with Our Lady. And I would not put it past him. I'd spoken to one cardinal one time off camera and off air, and he indicated that was indeed the case. But again, I don't know if that's ever been verified. We do know that the Holy Father had a certain level of mysticism, but he understood how important Our Lady was in these times. And we are living, as you know, Patrick, in very special times. You know, throughout the course of the past 2,000 years, from the time Christ publicly proclaimed Our Lady as our spiritual mother, we see her intercession in Saragossa. We see her across the decades, across the centuries even. But in our own day and age, there's an unprecedented number of Marian apparitions taking place. And we see John Paul in particular really entrusting the world, the church, and all of us to her maternal care. Maybe you can speak to that. What is it about our own era, our own time, this age, and the importance of Our Lady in it?
Yeah, I think there's a certain urgency here because I look at it this way. Every morning I get up and put my feet on the floor, I'm a day closer to heaven. I'm a day closer to the day where I take my last breath and behold the face of God. So at the same time, with every day that goes by, the earth, the planet, humanity is closer to its judgment day, to the end of time. And we're drawing close to that. How close? We don't know. It might be another 1,000 years. But there seems to be an urgency if Jesus keeps sending his mother back to remind us that we need to repent, we need to turn back to God, that we need to pray, we need to have that intimacy with God and that relationship with her son, because the time is coming. It's very close. And, you know, we know this from Faustina, that we're living in this time of mercy. But when does the time of mercy end? It will end, and then there'll be a time of justice. So this is all wrapped in the same message, that we need to prepare our hearts to meet God, and that every action, every thought, every word needs to be oriented toward the good. You know, sort of an aside, but not really, I wrote a foreword to a new book that's coming out on Blessed Carlo Acutis. Mm. And this was a young man who died at 15 years old. He died, I want to say 2007, 2008. And he really understood the preciousness of time, that time is short. He woke up every morning and spent every day thinking about our Lord and our Lady and how to orient his life toward holiness and to be a witness to those around him, no matter who they were. And remarkable young man. And he was vastly influenced by John Paul II and a great devotion to St. Francis and John Paul II. So there are saints among us who are showing us, in the third millennium, how to live a holy life. And we need to take notice of them and imitate their example.
You know, the other thing I always found striking, I think saints know saints, and saints meet saints. You know, you and I both know Father Seraphim Mikalenko. His cause isn't even open, but I really think that guy one day will be a saint. You've met John Paul. I've met John Paul II. I mean, you think about the people whose lives you come across today. But even if you turn the hands of time back a little bit, you know, John Paul, his factory was not far from where St. Faustina's convent was. You know, you take a look at Maximilian Kolbe, you take a look at Pio, take a look at all these saints who lived in the 20th century whose paths had crossed. It's pretty amazing. And I think that the times in which we live in today, more than ever, are incredibly grace-filled, because I think as evil rises, and we're clearly seeing that, grace abounds all the more. And I'm delighted to do my small part in bringing Christ to others. Let's take a few calls. I only have a few moments. My guest today, Patrick Nowakowski. If you want to read his book, he wrote a book called 100 Ways John Paul II Changed the World. Well worth reading. I'll let you get in here at 888-914-9149. You can call right now. As I said, I only have a few moments. Todd is listening in Lexington, Kentucky. Hi, Todd. Good afternoon.
Hi. How are you guys today?
We're great. Hanging in there. Doing well.
My question is, when he made the consecration in 1984, it was what, maybe 5 years afterwards that the Berlin Wall came down. When that consecration was made, was that the beginning of the end of communist domination of Europe and Russia's hold on Eastern Europe at that time? It seems like it's pretty not coincidental, but rather uncanny that happened within the next 4 or 5 years afterwards, that things began to really accelerate and the wall came down and freedom began to emerge.
Todd, I think you're right on the money. Go ahead. No, Patrick,
I really think that the beginning of the end for the Soviet Union, for Eastern communism, was when John Paul went to Poland in June of 1979 and called down the Holy Spirit on the land. I think the consecration was another step in that. You have to remember that around this time that Poland declared martial law and there were hundreds of people who were being beaten and jailed, and it was a very messy time. But I think that was part of the reaction on their part to this unprecedented change in the Polish people that they could not stop. And I think the consecration kind of quelled that. It kind of changed so many. I really believe it changed thousands of hearts, if not hundreds of thousands of hearts, because it put a stop to the violence, in a sense, that was going on. And then the dominoes started to fall even more quickly, Todd. So I think that you had something there.
Yeah, no, I have no doubt in my mind. I really believe that that's something Our Lady had requested. You know, it was fulfilled by John Paul II. And to your point, the Iron Curtain, you know, it collapsed. There was no gunfire. There were no tanks rolling in. There were no bombs being set off. The Soviet Union broke apart. Russia turned away from communism. They enacted new laws that allowed religious freedom and the worship of God. And we know that, you know, conversion often involves a process. It involves gradual change, right? It's not always instantaneous, instantaneously as we sometimes want it to be for our loved ones. And sometimes it is. Sometimes you have those Saul to Paul moments, but sometimes it takes a long time to turn around, you know, to amend our ways and to get into these new patterns of behavior. And I think that's what we saw with Russia. We saw it in the Christian church. You know, and we're seeing it in so many other areas. I got to take a quick break here, Patrick. I'm being told I've got to take a short pause. When we come back, we'll pick it up on the other side. If you want to join us, 888-914-9149. So before I go to break, though, very quick final thought here. Barb Ernster, Dave Carollo, both come from the World Apostolate of Fatima. They've said that, you know, Sister Lucia said the consecration was done. I know there's a lot of controversy over it. But she said very famously, October 11th, I think 1993, Sister Lucia gave a rather compelling recorded interview with Cardinal Vidal. She says, Fatima is just in the third day of the week. We got 7 days of the week, right? We are now, she says, in the post-consecration period. The first day was the apparition. The second was the post-apparition. Then you had this pre-consecration period. She says, the Fatima week hasn't ended. And how can one expect it to be over immediately, right? You know, people think of things in their own time frame, but Fatima is still in the third day. The triumph is an ongoing process, and the consecration of the world to Our Lady's Immaculate Heart was part of that process, because she said in Fatima, in the end, my Immaculate Heart will triumph. October 8th, 2000, John Paul, 21 years ago, entrusted the entire millennia, the next 1,000 years, to the power and the protection of the Mother of God. I think those graces are still flowing. I think great things loom in the world's future. It's up to us to respond. Short break, and we'll be back with your calls and more right after this.
Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio Studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forester.
Well, thanks for being with me today. Hey, it's a busy day, right? We're talking today about the anniversary of the entrustment of the third millennium to the Mother of God. What's it mean? What kind of graces flow? I've invited Patrick Novakoski to join me. He's an expert on John Paul II, and he's the one who did that entrustment on that day. And by the grace of God, I happen to be there. And I wanted to share it with you because I do believe we live in very special times. We also talk about the Great Chicago Fire and the Peshtigo Fire, even the Feast of St. Bridget. I believe it's her feast day today, and she was given those very powerful beads of the Seven Sorrows. And I do want to share a little bit of that with you coming up, too. But before I move on, Patrick, I just want to give you the opportunity for some final thoughts on the times in which we live, the importance of this entrustment, and maybe how people can get connected to you as well.
Yeah, goodness. You know, John Paul II's devotion to Our Lady is really a template for what we need to follow. When he lost his mother, I think he was 8 years old, his father would take him to the shrine of Our Lady of Częstochowa, the Black Madonna in Jasna Góra, Poland. And he would go there on a regular basis and just pour out his heart, his pain to Our Lady, and she would console him. And that the pain that people are feeling now is their separation from God. You know, I really think that, you know, we can, by our prayers, by our example, by our devotion to Our Lady, can turn many, maybe not everyone, but we can turn many back to God. And it's just a matter of making that commitment to daily prayer, to begging Our Lady for grace for our loved ones, and we'll see miracles. We really will. I mean, I say this all the time. God has always been a God of miracles. Why should he stop now unless we just don't have the faith to let those graces loose from heaven?
Yeah, I could not agree more. If people want to follow you, Patrick, or they want to get connected to you, what's the best way to do that?
Yeah, my website, booksbypatrick.com. You can find my book there. You can find ways to connect with me for giving talks or for other things. You can find me on Facebook and LinkedIn and Twitter. Not so active on Twitter, but on the other platforms, I'm very active. So feel free to reach out and connect with me any of those ways.
You got it. Hey, Patrick, keep up the good work, okay? I always appreciate having you here.
Thank you, my friend.
God bless you. That's Patrick Novakoski. And I want to also get you plugged in to a giveaway that we have. I think today, and Maggie, maybe you can help me. I think today's the last day. No, next week is. I think the 18th is your last day to get in on this. The 15th is the last day to sign up, Maggie's telling me. I'll get it right. The 18th is actually the drawing. What am I talking about? Let me tell you. All right. Do you like that four-letter word, free, F-R-E-E? Everybody does, right? Yeah, I got your attention, didn't you? You say four-letter word and suddenly people's ears perk up. Relevant's giving you a gift, and I've been talking about it all week, and next week, you have one more week to sign up. I wouldn't put it off. They are making available for Advent and for the upcoming Christmas season. They want to give you what is really a beautiful nativity set, and I don't know if you have one in your house or not. You might have a small one. I was given this when I joined the network. There's a beautiful donor who supported Relevant Radio for years, and this is part of her ministry to make sure Christ is in Christmas, and she loves these nativity sets, and they're not inexpensive. If you were to buy this somewhere else, it's about $500, and she's gone ahead and donated 200 of these beautiful hand-painted outdoor steps, and you can put them in your home. I had mine in my home at one point. Some of my colleagues have actually built like a little manger. And they put it outside and they put a light on it. That's what I ended up doing, putting it right out front of my front door, my steps, right after, you know, the walkway leading up, I should say, to the steps. Because it's beautiful. You know, you can put a light on it, and as people come to visit you during the holidays, as the snow falls, here you've got the meaning for the season. You've got Christ. You've got those beautiful figures that I'd love to talk about. I have such love for Our Lady. Her yes changed the world. It really did. She had free will, and her participation in salvation history, we owe a great deal of respect to her. She was pure. She was virginal. She said yes. Of course, we know as a result of that, we now celebrate the incarnation, God made man, God taking on our flesh, conquering sin, opening the gates of heaven for us. And in this scene as well, we have none other but this man of profound faith and trust, a man who was a guardian and a provider for the Holy Family, St. Joseph, and a man who I know has interceded powerfully in my life and I'm sure in yours. Those are the three key figures. There's other figures, of course, but look, this is a great gift. And if you want it, it's free. Like I said, F-R-E-E. Doesn't cost you a penny. All you have to do is go to relevantradio.com. Keyword is just Christmas. It's relevantradio.com/Christmas. And just put your name in and sign up and win. You know, maybe you say, I have a nativity set. I got it when I was in Israel, or I got it in Italy, or I love this. Well, sign up for it and give it to your kids. Give it to somebody else. Let's spread the true meaning of Christmas, all right? And again, October 18th, we will draw names. You'll be notified. 200 lucky people will get this, but the opportunity ends 1 week from today. So I just want to keep it before you and say, hey, why not? I'm going to actually tell my sister about the campaign. Have her put her name in there too. Why not, right? Look, you can join me too for the chat, but we're going to pray coming up here at 888-914-9149, 888-914-9149, and I would love to pray with you. Today is the anniversary of a great saint, Saint Bridget of Sweden. She was the daughter of a Swedish governor, and Saint Bridget, when she was just a child, when she was 7 years old, she began to have visions in which she saw Our Lady. As I mentioned, the Virgin Mary has appeared across the century, and she's come to all the great saints. Saint Faustina had visions. She had apparitions of the Mother God. It wasn't just Jesus. And those visions, starting at this very young age of seven, would continue throughout her life. And, of course, they were highlighted by, like Saint Faustina, these appearances of Jesus. And from childhood, she would meditate on the passion of our Lord. She was given a gift. She was given a very special devotion, a devotion to a prayer in which she would meditate on the sorrows of our Blessed Mother. And this is an ancient prayer, an ancient devotion, dates back to St. Bridget. And it seems that God wants this prayer prayed. You know, I'm an advocate of the chaplet. I'm going to pray it with you in just a couple minutes here. This is a gift given by heaven, right? The rosary given to St. Dominic. You know, we've had this, and we saw the defeat of the Albigensian heresy. We've seen its power against communism and evil. We've seen how much Satan hates it, right? Exorcists will talk about the power of the rosary. There's another prayer that I think is equally as powerful and works great miracles. There's a New York Times best-selling author. Her name is Immaculée Ilabogiza. She wrote a book called Left to Tell, and she has taken this as part of her mission because in Rwanda, there was a visionary, a girl who saw the Mother of God. Her name was Marie-Claire Mukangango. And the Virgin came to her and told her to pray this prayer. She wanted to reintroduce to the world the beads of the seven sorrows, the rosary of the seven sorrows. And it consists of seven groups of seven beads, and you meditate on the seven sorrows of the Blessed Mother. You know, her prophecy of Simeon, the flight into Egypt, when she lost Jesus, you know, when she met Christ on the way to Calvary at the crucifixion, when she took his dead body from the cross, when she placed him in the tomb. Those are the sorrows of Our Lady. And Our Lady attached unbelievable promises to this prayer. St. Bridget was given it, and today it's coming up as well. So if you are looking to amp up your spiritual life, look into the extraordinary life of St. Bridget, the great saint today. We'll call upon intercession. And maybe like the rosary, like the chaplet, here's another great devotion, which started with St. Bridget, coming again today in our own time through Our Lady, that can answer some of those prayers that you want and enrich your spiritual life. You know, I love it. You meditate on the life of Christ through the rosary, the chaplet. We meditate on his great passion. This, you meditate on the sorrows of Our Lady. Powerful stuff. I'll be right back.